Hello, my name is Colin Daniels. I'm the Working Age and Young People Service Manager for the Macular Society. Now, as you might know, the Macular Society hosts two live webinars each month focusing on all aspects of living with macular disease. We speak to leading experts, clinicians, and researchers about the latest in macular disease. The first of the webinars focuses very much on age-related macular degeneration, and the second on areas for people of a working age and a bit younger. Now, we understand that not everyone has the opportunity to watch our webinars, so we have decided to turn some of the content into podcasts. The podcasts will be available on all good podcast platforms. So here we go. So we're here today with Professor Lisa Kofi from UCL. Introduce him in a wee second. We've got a couple of other people on the call. So the first person I would like to introduce is Jerry Hode, who's the Macular Society Research Manager.
Yes, I'm the research manager. So I look after all the research projects that the Macular Society funds. It's a very important part of what we do, as well as our services and support for people with macular degeneration. We spend about £1.5 million a year on research, currently funding about 20 projects. Some of those involve stem cells, some of those involve gene therapy. Obviously, they cover lots of dystrophies and lots of projects on AMD. We don't have any on myopic macular degeneration, but that is something I want to change in the near future. But I'm looking forward to hearing what Pete has to say.
Brilliant. Perhaps chat with her as well a bit later on. The next person I want to introduce is Heloise Law, and she is a patient with a myopic macular degeneration. And she was one of the reasons that we were able to set this meeting up. So she's going to deal with all the chats and the questions that you guys might want to ask later on. So hi, Heloise, how are you?
Hello, everyone. Very pleased to be here. Yes, I'm going to be asking Professor Kofi the questions. We've had lots of interesting queries already, and I'm looking forward to seeing what else gets put in the chat during the course of the event.
I'd like to introduce Professor Pete Kofi, who we all know from UCL and all the fantastic work that he's been doing into stem cells. And I'm just going to sort of hand over to you, really, Pete, because I'm sure you know yourself a lot better than I do.
Colin, yeah, I definitely know myself, especially over this last year's lock-in, that's for sure. You get to know yourself better. Good evening, everyone, and it's a pleasure, again, to be talking with the Macular Society. What I want to do today is actually discuss myopia because of an interest I've had within this area because of the adult later stages of the disease, which I think tend to lend itself to therapies which the London Project has been developing for the age-related form of macular degeneration. So I'm just going to briefly go over some of the opponents of myopia, but then to get to the reason why I think regenerative medicine may have a place and a therapeutic towards the later stages of myopia. So, as I say, I'm going to go quickly through these. The problem with myopia is this problem around the ability to focus the outside world on the retina. And normal way, in terms of a normal eye and a normal lens, focuses it back into the macular region, where we focus the outside world. In the case of myopia, there is an excessive growth. And I'm not going to go into all the reasons as to why that happened, but basically the problem being there's an excessive growth which is considered to develop at a young age, and it may be due to the involvement in terms of the amount of close work which is done in childhood, the amount of light, whether it be outside or inside, but it's the development and the over excessive size of the eye leading to this, what's known as high myopia, whereby the outside world can't be focused easily in terms of the lens and the rest of the structures within the eye. Now, I'm going to go towards that pathologic myopia, but I'm just going to lead us up to that event. So the problem with that oversize, and in this top, you see a normal eye, and in B, in the right or in the middle, you actually see a myopic eye. So in the B, you can see that there's a difference in size. And then on the right is just a drawing. The right shows you, the blue shows you the normal eye size, and the red shows you the excessive growth in a myopic eye. But amazingly, that overgrowth has impact both in terms of the actual image that you're trying to focus. It has a problem in terms of just a general biology in the back of the eye and the biology of the back of the eye. Also in the support of the various components that are needed to keep that eye functioning correctly, and also in the blood supply at the back of the eye, and effectively the globe which holds the whole of the eye, which is the sclera at the back. So even though this is a developmental issue and it's only a size issue, it has a major impact on nearly every component and biological component of the eye. Now, my interest in this is obviously, as with my reasons for age-related macular degeneration, is just the sheer number and population of people. And here I'm just showing you that population in terms of high myopia. And this is people between the ages of 18 and 40, and the percentage that fall into this group as a percentage of their population. So while Denmark is quite small, as the further you go east, then that increase becomes very significant. And some numbers now that are coming out in terms of 20-year-olds even within the Asian continent, nearly 95% are not high myopic, but they're definitely myopic. So this whole problem there in terms of the size and the population, and in fact, the actual growth in that population, clinical population, and definitely into the near future. So once there's a clear indication of the onset of myopia, can you then in some way delay or suppress or slow down? And again, I'm not going to go into this because this is more towards, you know, young adults, children. Is there ways of actually affecting the progression and the speed of that? And there is. There are ways in which this has been addressed in terms of glasses, in terms of the use of atropine, et cetera. But I'm not going to discuss any of that. One of the things undoubtedly, or one of the questions which I am preempting, as in I would have thought someone would ask, is, well, what about gene therapy? Well, gene therapy is great if it is basically one gene which seems to be the fault and the cause of whatever the disease is. There's been a few studies now here in London at Moorfields Eye Charity in California. 23andMe in genetics has been involved in this. And if you try and identify what genes appear to be associated with myopia, both in the development, the progression, and the various stages, then it's absolutely not one gene. There's a whole list of genes. And in fact, there's not a single component or part of the eye and its genetic material which does not appear to be involved in myopia. And that's not surprising because it is a developmental issue. There are so many genes involved in the different ways different cells develop, and all of those appear to be impacted in myopia in terms of that development. So would genetic or gene therapy be possible? No, not really. There is some indication that in high myopia and in certain families, there may be certain genes which are more expressed in higher myopes and higher myopes families. But again, that doesn't preclude the fact that there is a whole gamut of genes which appear to be involved and affected. So gene therapy, which will target and typically targets just one gene or a very, very small class of genes, is not a very good target for myopia. So what I want to come to is, developmental wise, you may be able to stop the progression. There may be possibilities there in terms of using various aspects in terms of lenses, in terms of LASIK, in terms of atropine to slow the development of myopia. But what happens if you actually go to that high myopic stage and you are effectively going into a pathological component? So the question is, how prevalent is this type of myopic macular degeneration? And in low myopes, it's very small. It's about 8% of the population of low myopes. In high myopes, it's about 29%, 30 to 29% in the high myopes. But what is staggering is when you actually put those numbers into the number of people who are now suffering from myopia. And without doubt, within a very short period between 2030, 2050, there could be almost a billion people suffering myopic macular degeneration, which is way bigger than the number we'll be suffering from age-related macular degeneration. Why is it that I'm talking to you? And it's because the therapy we've been developing for the London Project, which people may or may not know, has been my major target, lends itself to myopic degeneration. And I just want to give you an indication of why, and then tell you about some of the work which we're doing now. So just to go back a step, I mean, the beauty of the eye is obviously we can look through it, and that red reflection gives a picture of the back of the eye. And those pictures now can be commonly taken even at your opticians. And what we're talking about in macular degeneration is an area. The macula is not in itself a disease, it's a geographic location in the back of your eye. And basically, it's a circle, roughly a circle, about 10 millimeters, which also includes the major focal area where you focus the world, called the fovea, which is about a millimeter. So it's this area, both in age-related macular degeneration and in myopia, in which if there is any disturbance or degeneration here, then your fine detail, your ability to read, your ability to recognize faces, etc., will be compromised. So if you think of the back of the eye almost as layers of an onion, you've got three layers. You've got the top part, which contains all the cells that are sensitive to light. You've got, which is called the neural retina. You've then got a middle layer, and that's called RPE. The name is retinal pigment epithelium, but I'm not going to test anyone. Let's just call it the RPE. But it's crucial to keeping that top part, the retina, healthy. And then you have a massive blood supply behind it, which gives nutrients to the RPE for it then to give it to the retina. And then behind the choroid, you then have a cup in which the eye is contained called the sclera. And in myopia, in the early stages, the major problem is because of that mechanical stress, the size of the eye is bigger than would normally be. There's mechanical stress on those cells, on that sheet of cells, the blood supply, the choroid, and the RPE. And that starts to cause a breakdown in the vessels, a breakdown in that middle layer, because that middle layer is, it's almost like a fence. It's a barrier to the outside world for many reasons, but I'm not going to go into those today. But those two layers, the choroid and the RPE, start to deteriorate. And as some of you know, that deterioration initially can lead to bleeds as well. Now, this is not dissimilar to the problem we see in patients with age-related macular degeneration. In age-related macular degeneration, the first layer we see that deteriorates is the middle layer, the RPE, and then the choroid, and then the neural retina. So with the later stage, because the choroid and the RPE have gone through this stress, those cells start to die, those layers start to break down, and then that top layer with the light sensitive cells starts to die as well. So regenerative medicine, a new paradigm, is trying to in some way rebuild those layers. Can we rebuild a blood supply at the back of the eye? Can we rebuild that middle layer? And can we rebuild that light sensitive top layer? And the answer is that's what we're trying to do. And we've succeeded in doing that in the first stage of the London project. We've managed to do that in the middle layer. So we can reconstruct. When I say reconstruct, it's not just a case of putting things back, it's making sure the architecture is the same as well. And we can do that for the RPE. But with myopia, we need to be able to build a new blood supply at the back. We need to do that middle layer, the RPE, and we've done that. We've done that even in patients. And we also need to make light sensitive cells. So the rest of this talk, while we're dealing with this in terms of age-related macular degeneration, it is totally usable as a therapeutic in which any of these layers are affected, which is what is the problem in myopia. These are the layers that are affected. So those parts, as in the blood supply, the RPE and the photoreceptors, make up that crucial macular component. So can we actually start to really rebuild a macula? So blood supply, can we make a blood supply? And this is the second part of the London project. So in doing the blood supply, we need to make this choroid structure at the back. It's a structure which is, in terms of its blood supply, is huge because of the amount of work that's going on in terms of the eye. So to build a blood supply, we need the building blocks. And the first one is the lining of the vessels, of the blood vessels. And they're a specific cell, very different from the RPE, called the endothelium. We then need to make tubes. Okay, so we need to be able to literally make a vessel. And then secondly, we need to make sure those vessels are open and allow blood to go down. And the good news, and we can make the starting cells. So we can make those cells which line the blood vessels, endothelial cells. And in fact, to make them only takes 6 days, which is pretty staggering. But amazingly, we can get them to make a vessel. We can make them, or they can make networks of vessel. What we've also shown, and what we, when I say we, it's two very talented researchers at the Institute of Ophthalmology, they've managed also to make sure that these vessels allow fluid to go down them. And that's by putting in a lining of cells as well as those blood vessels, which allows blood to flow. Equally, those individuals have also been able to build the next stages of the whole macula. So we can bring together the middle layer, which is the RPE, and the blood vessels. So now we have two of the three components building towards a sandwich. So now we have two of the three components to rebuild a macula. The question is, can we actually make the light sensitive cells? And this is probably one of the trickiest components, but the answer is yes. We can now build a retina in a dish. We can make a light sensitive retina in a dish. We can make photoreceptors, or light sensitive cells, which are called rhodopsin. And they're the cells you use at night. And we can make two of the cones, which are the cells in that central macular region, which is called LMopsin and Sopsin. So we now have a supply of that third component, which is the photoreceptors. So we are close to being able to seriously think of rebuilding a macula in those individuals in which there is this late stage disease, in which both in myopia and also in age-related macular degeneration, where blood supply is affected, the support cells, the RPE are affected, and there's also death of the photoreceptors. So the ability to try and replace all three layers. So to finalize, while my research has been focused on AMD, age-related macular degeneration, those components are usable equally for a treatment in myopia, in terms of both the early stages of degeneration, which would be that blood supply and the support cells at the back of the eye, because of the physics, the mechanics, due to the increased size in the eye. And then later on, the possibility of introducing light sensitive cells, again, produced from stem cells. I'm going to leave it there because I wanted to say that one of the big issues, crazily doesn't seem to be the issue for age-related macular degeneration, is there's little funding going in to myopic macular degeneration. Even though those numbers are huge, there's at the moment, most of the attention in terms of the research is in suppressing the development of the myopia in obviously children, etc. There's very little funding in terms of research, either clinically or else, to actually target or even use some of the technologies and techniques we're using in AMD to transfer that over to myopia. So it would be great here to obviously help the Macular Society in terms of gaining some funding, whether it be from interested pharmaceutical companies or pushing government. Novartis have made a very strong statement that they're wanting to actually invest in myopia and in definitely in the late stages of myopia for research. So there's a number of institutions and pharmaceutical groups now which are getting very, very interested in myopia because of the unmet need and the huge population, which is definitely going to happen in these younger people coming through now with very, very large numbers of high myopics.
We have to agree with you, Pete. We do. It's as Geraldine said before, you know, the Macular Society has always wanted to encourage people to fund research into myopic MD, and I think the momentum is starting to build up. Well, thank you very much for your presentation, and I'm sure we've got loads and loads of questions. So I'm going to hand directly over to Heloise, and she can ask you some questions that have come in both from before the session, and I'm sure we've had some through the chat. So Heloise, over to you.
Thanks, Colin. Okay, so we've got some sort of slightly more technical questions and some more general ones. I'll start you off with a technical one, as you've just been talking us through so well, that incredible process. In the frame of MMD staging, Petra would like to know, so diffusion, patchy, geographic atrophy, at what point of the disease would the RPE patch that's being developed still work? At what point of the disease do photoreceptors actually die?
Great question. It's always, that is always the issue, is when do you go in with any therapeutic? So the earlier you can go in with an assurance that you're not going to cause damage is obviously the major concern for any surgical intervention. So ideally, if for example, we didn't have photoreceptors as part of the reconstruction, then you would definitely want to go in when you were seeing the early signs of degeneration of the RPE, but that you were confident that the overlying light-sensitive cells were still there and still alive. If the light-sensitive cells have died as well, then just putting RPE back is not going to result in any restoration of vision. What needs to be sort of stated is a stem cell is not what we're putting into an eye. We're using a stem cell to make the cells that are lost in the eye. We're turning them into a cell that we're replacing prior to putting them back into an eye. It's not commonly known, but stem cells don't know what they're meant to do. You can't just squirt a stem cell into an eye and expect it to replace RPE or replace photoreceptors. It wouldn't know how to do that. But you can actually turn stem cells into the eyes which are lost through that disease. But yes, if you have only got RPE and the choroid, you want to go in before those light sensitive cells die.
Thanks, Pete. A couple of people have asked about the shape of the myopic eyeball and whether the fact that it's, you know, abnormally elongated would affect the success of any kind of surgical intervention, and whether a patch, for example, would become damaged or degrade more quickly because of that. So to what extent is the kind of structural problems of the eyeball an issue for any kind of intervention of that nature?
Yeah, no, it's a great question again. The good thing in many ways is we'd be putting the patch in when the growth of the eye is stopped. So basically, you're actually putting it into the system once it's finished growing. If we'd actually put it in while it was still growing, then yeah, you may still get some tension on the patch and therefore some, you know, stress on it. If you're going in post-development, then basically the patch is just going to sit there in the position as the eye is, and therefore shouldn't be susceptible to the same sort of stress that was apparent during development.
Thank you very much. Various people have submitted questions about dry MD and about what exists for that kind of atrophic damage, and whether these types of therapy might be able to reverse that kind of damage, and what kind of research is being conducted into dry as opposed to wet MD. Had quite a number of questions of that nature.
So if you're going into dry is a very general definition, and it depends at what stage of that disease you go in. So again, if you're going into geographic atrophy, then typically there you have all three layers have been damaged and death. So the light sensitive cells have died, the RPE have died, and the choroid has died. So you would need all three layers as a treatment for that stage of the disease. You can go in earlier before the light sensitive cells go, and that obviously would mean you wouldn't need the photoreceptors as well. So again, it's dependent at the stage of the disease when you actually deliver the therapy. Again, the major issue there is you obviously don't want to go into the disease and make more damage. So you need to make sure that the surgical intervention, whatever stage you go in, is obviously appropriate for the stage of that intervention in that disease. But again, going into late stage or end stage dry with just RPE will not actually benefit a person if they've lost vision due to death of the overlying light sensitive cells. That would not be recovered just by giving RPE.
Okay, thanks very much. And perhaps building on the back of that, Geraldine asks whether you're going to replace the Brooks membrane.
Yeah, Brooks membrane was part of what we already do in the London project. So we have an artificial membrane which we already put in patients with the RPE. So yes, we would be replacing the RPE Brooks membrane. The next stage would be RPE Brooks membrane and choroid. And then the final stage, which is way complex, is the final stage is all three layers. So photoreceptors, RPE, Brooks membrane, and choroid.
Amazing. So futuristic and exciting. Three people have asked about the other pathologies to which the myopic eye is subject, and whether a person who also had, for example, glaucoma or other complications related to pathological myopia might be suitable for these types of treatment.
Yeah, again, it depends on the extent of that pathology. You know, the glaucoma, again, because of the physical size and probably a closure of the angle, means that there is increased pressure in the eye. So there's a few things that can be done there to try and help in terms of reducing the pressure, but it shouldn't in any way negate the ability to use, you know, the macular reconstruction. But you would want to try and lower the pressures as well in some way, which could be done pharmacologically, possibly.
Thank you very much. So we've had quite a lot of sort of technical questions. Understandably, this is all Exciting stuff. A slightly different question now. This has come in from three different people. Can you say something about the relationship between AMD and MMD? So can someone with MMD also get AMD? Can you talk a little bit about the distinction between those two types of macular degeneration?
I mean, in its simplest definition, then myopic macular degeneration is due to this oversize and mechanical stress, whereas AMD is considered to be obviously a disease of age, which does have susceptibility due to, you know, genetics, and may have, you know, inflammatory age type components. So they're distinguished by the fact that myopia is definitely considered to be this oversize of the eyeball, as opposed to AMD, which is just considered to be age-related and due to potential susceptibility. Can you actually get AMD if you've got MMD? In many ways, as I've just shown you, the similarities is almost identical in terms of the cell layers that are affected. So it doesn't really matter in terms of MMD, in that the cell layers are still the same as AMD. I think in many ways, that's why there's an opportunity here to consider the therapeutics that are being used for AMD to also be considered potentially useful for MMD.
Thanks, Pete. And just perhaps building on the back of that, are there any plans to include any MMD patients in a trial, or are there plans to start a dedicated MMD trial, even a small one?
So it's a great question, and there's been a couple of groups who have considered it, but again, it's because the funding towards myopia and definitely MMD hasn't been there to actually do these clinical trials. Even the London project has considered it, but clearly what we're trying to do is actually go through the regulatory process to get it approved for AMD. So, I mean, it is a funding issue. There are a number of groups that are using this regenerative medicine approach. It does get suggested at a number of meetings and in a number of papers, but at the moment, there's no clinical trial heading towards this type of use of regenerative medicine. There was, and I checked before coming on this call, there was possibly a trial happening in California, but that does not seem to be happening at the moment.
Got a question for you about scar tissue. Is there a way to replace photoreceptors in an area of scar tissue? Patients with scar tissue, says Kimberly, are not often candidates for stem cell trials. Have you got any comments about that?
Scar tissue can be removed. Again, the removal and the surgery itself can cause certain complications. But at the moment, the trials for the use of a stem cell-derived light-sensitive cell still are in their infancy. So it's not the case that they couldn't be used, but they're tending to go for very specific groups with just photoreceptor degeneration, which is dissimilar to myopia, as I showed you. It's more layers are affected due to that mechanical stress. So the first light-sensitive photoreceptor transplants are going to go for diseases commonly grouped together known as retinitis pigmentosa, RP.
Okay, thank you. Two people have asked about the stem cells and where they come from. Are they derived from the patient? How do you get them?
So there are two sources that you can use. One is the embryonic source, which are produced from donated blastocysts. And the second one is, as questioners highlighted, is this new technology. Well, it's not that new anymore, which is the induced pluripotent stem cells, which is you can take a sample of a person's skin or blood, and actually we can do it with urine now. We've done this with children. You can take samples and make their own stem cells from those samples, so from skin or blood or urine, and then actually use that as the source of the stem cell, and then turn those called iPS cells into the cell that's diseased and died in the patient. It's very expensive. It is very, it's personalized medicine to an exact, because it's actually, you know, obviously using the patient's own cells. It's then manufacturing them to put them back into that said patient. So at the moment, that's a very expensive route. There are ways in which groups are trying to improve on that, so that one source of iPS cells could be used for a number of patients rather than it just being for an individual.
Thank you very much. Fascinating stuff. How long will it be, about three or four people have asked, until this type of treatment is available to somebody with MMD? What's the time frame?
So the RPE one could be a matter of a couple of years. RPE and choroid will come after that, and probably a couple of years after that. So we're already up to nearly 5 years. Photoreceptors on their own is something which is being trialed and will be trialed over the next couple of years. But again, that's something which then could quickly be brought into this arena, as in myopia. So the area is fast moving, as gene therapy was fast moving. Regenerative medicine, specifically in the eye now, is very, very fast moving. So there will be a lot of trials reading out over the next 2 or 3 to 5 years, which will really give an indication of their potential and definitely their potential use for MMD.
And a quite a specific question here. Will this treatment work for people with macular degeneration caused by PIC? And I'm going to try and remember what the acronym stands for. It's punctuate inner choroid something, and you're going to help me out now.
Yeah, no, it would. It would, yeah. So again, it's a consideration which we ourselves have had. So, you know, if we get it licensed for AMD, then it opens up the opportunity, like I say, not just for myopia, but there are other diseases of the RPE which are specifically genetic, MERTK, LRAT, etc., and also PICs as well. So there are those possibilities, yeah.
Would stem cell treatment and the types of therapy you've been describing be appropriate for somebody with wet MD but who hasn't got atrophy?
Yeah, so the answer to that is really easy, because that's the first clinical group we went into with the RPE patch. So the answer is absolutely yes.
Great. Straightforward, enthusiastic yes there. Lovely.
Yep.
So a question on a slightly different topic, but three people have asked it, which is about pregnancy and MMD. There's obviously very little data on the use of anti-VEGF agents in pregnancy for people experiencing CNV. Do you have any comments to make about treating pregnant patients with wet MMD?
It's a very good question. I mean, the issue there is obviously unlike a systemic treatment. I mean, the anti-VEGF is actually given very locally, obviously, into the eye. Equally, it's also a very small amount. There are some, there has been about one study which has suggested, but it's really rare, that the anti-VEGF can actually exit the eye, but it's in small quantities. Obviously, it's an anti-vascular, so it is a concern within pregnancy. But at the moment, I mean, I'm not sure what the position is, for example, here in Moorfields. I don't know of anything at the moment to suggest a major issue, although it would be something you'd need to, you know, ask your clinician.
Thanks very much. I'm sure that would be interesting and reassuring to the people who I know have that concern at the moment. Slightly different question now. Does your eye keep on growing? Does it ever stop? Somebody has asked.
It does, and that's the issue with myopia. So if your eye keeps growing and goes hyper or high myope, it does eventually stop. That's why I'm saying, you know, the big issue for us is not really the same concern in terms of the stresses on the patch, because once the eye is of a certain size, it's not going to keep on continually growing. The problem is, though, there are changes in the actual refractive components of your eye, and they do keep changing over age. So, you know, around about 45, you know, reading a newspaper became very difficult because suddenly I had the onset of presbyopia. So, you know, that's why I'm now wearing glasses. So, you know, there is this issue about refractive changes still occurring over age, but in terms of length and shape of the eye, that tends to be much more simpler in terms of the length of development.
Okay, thank you. Somebody whose central vision has already been adversely affected, is there any chance that that vision can be restored by the types of treatment you've been discussing tonight?
Well, that would be the goal. I mean, if the individual has obviously lost the central vision, it sounds like they've probably in a position where those light sensitive cells in some way have been disrupted. So in that case, it would be a need to go for some type of photoreceptor or light sensitive therapeutic.
So the last pair of questions I've got for you are about funding and access. So can individuals or private sponsors assist with MMD trial funding? How much is needed? And you may not be able to answer that, the questioner realises. And what about people from outside the UK? Might they be eligible for an MMD trial if there was one in the UK?
So typically with any trial, there's a very strict criteria for entry into that trial. We obviously take a population which is within London, but that is extended beyond London, and patients can be enrolled from anywhere within the UK. Typically, it's only once those initial trials have been completed can those trials open up to other groups and other individuals, specifically potentially outside the UK. We did have, because of the EU, obviously legislation which allowed patients to move within Europe. There is a bit of an issue whether that is still in place at the moment because of Brexit. We've just had one concern just this week in whether we're allowed to actually include European patients. But I think in terms of the question you asked previously, in terms of funding, there's still a fair bit of preclinical work has to be done if it's the case that photoreceptors and or choroid are going to be included in these therapeutics. So it's not just the case of funding preclinical or trials. There's still some science that still needs to be funded to get it to the stage where we feel confident and safe that the therapeutic will have some impact. So, you know, if we look at the London project, this will frighten people now in terms of the number. If we look at the London project just to get it to that first stage of clinical trial, that was nearly 10 million. So it's not cheap.
A lot of money, isn't it? Research costs a lot of money, and it, but it does have its, you know, its benefits, and lots of people get the benefit from it. Really, really, thank you, Peter, for joining us. It's been great. Things are definitely progressing in the right direction. So thank you ever so much for your time, and I know you're a good friend to the Macular Society, so I'm sure you'll keep us updated with things that develop. Heloise, thank you for your time as well. You did that a lot better than I ever could. So thank you very much. So Joe, have you got anything to add or anything to say or question?
No, I just really to add to the fact that we'd love to fund some research. We're reliant on the moment on researchers submitting grant applications to us on myopic macular degeneration, and we put out the message, and I very much hope that we get some applications in and we can get start funding some work in this area. But, the researchers need to get on board with it as well.
So that only leaves for me to just to thank Pete again for his time this evening. So thank you very much. That was so interesting. Thanks for coming, and we shall catch you next time.
Thanks very much, Colin. Thank you, everyone.